Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Hi, my name is Brittany, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Brittany.
Hi, everyone. Glad to be here tonight. I'm always glad to be in a room with my fellows, with people just like me, because for a long time, I felt like nobody was like me. For a long time, I lived, I thought I was the only person in the world who felt the way I felt, that did the things that I did, that told the lies and said the things that I said. I thought I was the only person who was that terrible, that dishonest, that deceitful, that unkind, that hateful. I was so full of anger, that angry. And now I know you're all that screwed up too. So anyway, my name is Brittany, and I'm an alcoholic, and I do have a sobriety date. Because of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have not found it necessary to pick up a drink since December 27th of 2007. I believe that all those things I just mentioned, all that lying, deceit, anger, it started to change from that moment. It didn't all change. It didn't all get better all at once or even completely still. It's why it's a program of progress. But it all started to get better from the day I decided to do something about my condition, my alcoholism. At the time, I'm not one of those people that say, you know, I had no idea I was an alcoholic. I knew. There was no question about it. I did used to joke around about it in college. I would say, you know, oh, you're only an alcoholic till you graduate. You're not an alcoholic until you graduate, you know, because everyone in college does this. Everyone else is doing this. But it became very apparent to me very quickly that not everybody drank the way I drank. Not everybody did the things that I did. When I put alcohol into my body, I don't know how many more I'm going to have, and I don't know how I'm going to behave. That's just it. There's no, if I drink three drinks of this, I'll do this. If I drink four of that, there's no exact concoction. I tried to figure it out, that magic number, that magic elixir, you know, how can I get there to where I need to be, but still not like wake up in somebody else's bed. You know, I tried to figure that all out, and I was all consumed with that. Like, why can't I just drink like a normal person? Why when I take two drinks, I can't just say, okay, good night. Why? Why can my friends do it, but I'm the one who's closing the bar? Why can't I even get through my shift at work without reaching under the counter for a drink? Why can't I go to work without taking a drink? I didn't understand that. When I got to these rooms, I was 21 years old, and, you know, I honestly told me, even though I knew who I was and what I was, I honestly thought you were all going to tell me, come back in 20 years, like you're not a real alcoholic. And thank God you didn't. You know, thank God that you said, come on in, you're welcome here. Because I believe that at any age that we get here, whenever we get here, it's the right time to get here. I don't think any of, you know, I've heard this a lot in these rooms, and it's my experience, so I can say it from the podium, but, you know, I didn't come here off a winning streak, and I don't know anyone who has. You know, we don't just wake up one day and be like, oh, I had fun drinking last night, nothing bad happened, but I'll go to an AA meeting. It just doesn't happen that way. I came here because my life was absolutely unmanageable, and I couldn't put those words around it. I couldn't say that I was powerless over alcohol before I got here, and I couldn't say that my life was unmanageable, but I remember being in my first meeting and reading that step and hearing that step and feeling like that word unmanageable described everything I had been feeling about my life in the most perfect words. And powerless, that is absolutely my experience, is that I cannot put alcohol into my body without and safely say that I'm going to drink this or I'm going to do that, or, you know, because I did it. I tried so many times and it just didn't work. So I do have a sobriety date, and I don't, you know, when I'm asked to share from the podium, I think it's such a privilege. I've been sick, but, you know, I told Sarah I'm not canceling on you because it's so important to me that today, you know, I suit up and show up because there was a long time, people did not want me anywhere. People did not ask me to come places. They certainly wouldn't ask me to come into a church and talk to people, like, certainly not. But today people ask me to do things like that, and sometimes it still blows my mind, and I've been here a couple years, but you know, when I say I'm going to do something in Alcoholics Anonymous, I mean, I really, 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 really try to do it, you know, and if I can, I try to give notice, because that's just, basically, I was told that when you get here, you have to change everything, and at first, I was like, oh my gosh, like, these people, I couldn't even think about, all I wanted to do was just not drink, okay, I didn't know at the time I didn't want to just not drink. I knew I couldn't live the way I was living. I don't talk a whole lot about my childhood when I'm asked to speak from the podium because it really makes no difference in whether or not I'm an alcoholic. You know, I believe that I was born this way. I don't wish to argue that with anybody. I believe that I was an alcoholic from the start. I always felt I'm going to say this, but I want to preface it with saying, you know, I listen to a lot of speaker tapes, and I go to a lot of speaker meetings, and I go to conferences, and I love speakers, because, which is a change in and of itself, because when I first got here, I hated speaker meetings, because I wanted to talk about me, right? So I did not want to, like, sit and listen to you, because, like, I would love the speakers that ended, like, 5 minutes early, because I would be the first one to talk, because, you know, I just wanted someone to pay attention to me. I just wanted someone to, like, feel what I was feeling. So I listened to a lot of speakers, and every story is so different, and there are some obviously similar elements. That's why we get here. But one of the ones, I swear, I don't think there's one speaker tape that I've heard or speaker that I've listened to that has not started out, and somewhere in their story they say, I just felt different. I felt like I didn't belong. I felt, you know, and this, most of them say it goes way back before the drink, and for me it went way back before the drink. I didn't have the best childhood. I didn't have the worst. I can't sit up here and complain about that. But I was the kid in school that, like, I went to Catholic school, and it being a Catholic school has nothing to do with anything. I believe that we get ourselves in trouble when we put labels on things in these rooms. But I went to Catholic school for 9 years, and there were only, like, I think there were, like, 200 kids in from kindergarten to eighth grade. So it was a really small school. And I was the kid that, you know, I did well in school. And my whole life, I never knew it was okay to do well at something. You know, people in my family, of course, praised me, but kids in my school hated me. Like, I was, like, the teacher's pet, and they hated me. The nuns would stick me in the room and have me, like, tutor my peers, you know, because they didn't know what to do with me because they didn't have things like, you know, it was a private parochial school. They didn't have gifted programs. They didn't have all these resources we have today. So their solution was to have me grade my classmates' papers, you know, and so obviously no kid's going to like me. I wouldn't have liked me. You know, obviously the kids are all going to think I'm some weirdo, and I was, let's be honest. I love to get out my old yearbooks because it's like science fair, there I am, and the geography bee, and it's like, and it was like, and I talk about it now, and, you know, somebody said to me once, you don't have to brag about that. You don't understand. I was ashamed of that stuff. So now that I'm sober, I'm proud of that stuff, okay? And I'm not going to apologize for it, because if there's one thing that this program has given me, it's given me, I love me today. I hated me when I got here. I was ashamed of me. I had done so many terrible things. So for me to stand up here and be proud that I was in the geography bee, like, that's huge progress for me. It may not mean a lot to you, but I was ashamed of that stuff. I would purposely do poorly on paper so that I wasn't the top scorer in the class. I would purposely pretend to copy off of other kids just so they thought that I was, like, looking to them for, I mean, that's crazy. That's insanity. And that started in second grade, and I did not take a drink until I was, I mean, willfully take a drink, besides the blood of Christ, I guess, but willfully take a drink until I was I think a junior in high school when I was 17. So, I mean, from second grade, I can remember being, like, very aware of what you all thought about me. you know. And throughout the rest of my, you know, throughout my whole life, well into sobriety and sometimes still today, let's just be honest, I still can get really, really consumed with what you all think about me. Because until I got to that place where I only cared what he thought about me, what God thought about me, I could never be okay unless I had that top approval. Bill Wilson talks about it in The Language of the Heart in an article he wrote on called Emotional Sobriety, The Next Frontier. It's fantastic. If you don't read anything else from that book, I recommend that article, Emotional Sobriety, The Next Frontier. And he talks about how, you know, all of us alcoholics, you know, we all seek these three things, and we go on to the gates of insanity seeking them. It has nothing to do with a drink, but he talks about perfect security, perfect romance, and top approval, and how juvenile of those desires are, and how they might be okay for a kid like 12 years old, but they're not okay for adults, you know, to have those absolute ideals. And that was me. I wanted it all, or I didn't want any of it. And I can still have that very black and white thinking today, where I can't just sit and be okay with where I'm at. But anyway, I don't know how we got there, but it just happens sometimes. So, you know, the childhood was good. High school, childhood was as good as it, you know, I was fine. I used to like whine about how hard I had it. I'm like, are you kidding? Like now today, I'm like, are you kidding me? Like I had it great compared to some people. So I can't complain about that. You know, high school was a little bit better, not much. College was when I really, I took my first drink at 17, and I love to tell this when I share my story because it speaks so much of how I believe I was an alcohol. I always say I drank alcoholically from my first drink because I can tell you that the day I took my first drink, it was about 60 degrees outside. We were in a tent in my backyard. It was after my junior prom. Liz, DR, Ernie, Becca, and Gina were there. I could tell you what all of them wore. I could tell you that we drank Bacardi Razz and 99 Berries. I can tell you what I wore. I can tell you the snacks that we ate. I can tell you every little detail related to my first drink. I could not tell you who I got my first kiss from. I could not tell you the details of any first day of school ever. I could not tell you the details of my first a lot of other things. But I can tell you with absolute certainty everything about that moment. Everything. I can tell you, I remember how it smelled, I remember how it tasted, I remember how it felt when it hit the back of my throat and crawled down my bloodstream. I remember everything about that. I don't remember my first drink of chocolate milk. I just don't, you know? I just don't. But I love the effects produced by alcohol. And that's not just the effect on my body. I love the effect it had on my mind, on my psyche, on my spirit. I love the person it turned me into. I love that I took that drink of alcohol, and, you know, I always tell this in my story, you know, when I was 16 years old, fast forward a year before that, or rewind a year before that, I was 16 years old calling my mom crying to come pick me up from a friend's house because my friends were drinking alcohol, you know, crying, and I was so ashamed because I was this good kid, you know, and I didn't want to be around that stuff. And, you know, 5 years later, I'm the one in rehab, you know. But I can tell you everything about that first drink, and I can tell you that from that moment, I drank alcoholically. From that moment, I drank for effect. I loved how it made me feel. I got sick as anything, but it didn't matter. It didn't matter. And the second, third, fifth, 20th time I did it, I got sick still. It did not matter, you know. When I came in here and, you know, that I talked a lot about what it was like, and so I'll move on to the what happened. You know, I went to college. I went to three different colleges, you know, because, of course, it's always that's my version of the geographic cures. You know, I went to different colleges. So I went to Temple my freshman year, joined a sorority. I had arrived, you know. Now the guys that were, like, that I had crushes on in high school that bullied me. We went to the same college, and now they're trying to get into my parties. You know, they're coming up to parties I hosted and begging me to get them in. And it was like everything changed, and alcohol was the center of that. So, of course, that's what I focused on. And then I met a guy back home, and I left Temple for him because, you know, he got in the way of school. And then I went to Shippensburg, and I went to HAC, Harrisburg Area Community College, for like 5 minutes, and then some outside issues got in the way. And then and I say outside issues because we're in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, but let's be real, if I could eat dirt and it would make me feel altered, I'd eat dirt. That's just who I am. I like the effect produced by alcohol and anything else that will take me out of here. I like to be altered in any way, shape, or form possible because I can't stand myself in my own skin of myself without God's help and without your help. But we're in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I really respect primary purpose. But let's just, I mean, outside issues are a big part of my story. But so outside issues, I left HAC for that. And then I went to Shippensburg, and alcohol brought me to my knees because I turned 21. And I can tell you from the day I turned 21, those outside issues were no longer an issue anymore for me because I realized that that was the only thing standing between me and being a full-blown alcoholic all along was just, you know, ease of access. It was easier to get those outside issues than it was for me to get drunk. That's just how it was. But from the day I turned 21, I think I drank a bottle a day. And when I got here, you know, what happened part of my story is, I had nothing else. I had nowhere else to go. I had no other answers. I went through five jobs in 7 months. I could not hold down a job in a gas station. I could not hold down a job waiting tables. They had me cooking for like 20 minutes on a line at Applebee's. Like me cooking on, like drunk as anything, handling people's food is frightening. And yet, like I would do it. I worked a double shift there, and the whole time, like, God was doing for me what I couldn't do. Like, the whole time, God was there, and I never saw him, you know. I never saw that he was saving me time and time again and giving me so many chances. Where are you, God? Where are you, God? He's right there. You have to do some work, though, you know. And so I got fired, you know, I got fired from this job, and I really, like, hit my first bottom when I, like, couldn't even hold down a job in a gas station for 2 weeks because I couldn't, you know, I had, like, a four-hour shift and could not get through it without a drink and got caught drinking at work. Because it was like if I was on my way to work and I would have every willpower and resolve not to do it that day, I won't do that again. And then it's like, oh, I have 10 minutes left. There's a liquor store. My car just went into autopilot and I'd end up at the liquor store. And before you knew it, I was walking out of my shift drunk because I couldn't handle it anymore. I learned how to drink at work when I bartended. And before you knew it, like I was more drunk than the patrons at my bar, you know. And I was cooking at an Applebee's, and I worked double shifts, and the woman, there's a liquor store, I would go get my bottle in between the double, and the woman would, like, have it waiting for me, you know. It's like, still then, I didn't see, like, you might have a problem with this thing. But I think I probably did know that, but at that point, what else was I to do? I couldn't live without it. I couldn't go without it. I could not do anything without a drink. I used to wake up in the middle of the night, I drank till I passed out. That was the goal, right? Till I blacked out. And I had to start buying I used to like the flavored stuff. And then I was like, oh, this isn't working anymore because it's only 70 proof. So, you know, it's like I had this whole mathematical, I'm like a genius when it comes to alcohol, like how much you can get for this price. It's crazy. I can't pay my rent, you know, I can't write a check to save my life, but I can figure out, like, down to the ounce if the 30-pack is a better value than the case. I mean, it's just crazy, but my power, you know, I always tell a story of powerlessness, and, like, it's so dark, and I hate going there every time I tell my story, but it's so necessary that I go here, because when I sat in a speaker meeting for the first time, somebody went there with their powerlessness story, and it was like, I sat in that room, and I thought, oh my gosh, but that person never did this. And then I heard their story and I'm like, okay, I tell a powerlessness story about, I drank to blackout and I would come to in the middle of the night and not really know what was wrong, but I knew if I drank, I would be fine. And that, so, but my powerlessness story is like the liquor stores opened at 10 a.m. In Shippensburg. And I remember waking up one morning, and I always was very careful to only drink 3/4 of the bottle the night before and save a quarter for until the next morning. And I remember one morning I was out. And I remember I would save my empties really for the sole reason I didn't want my roommates to see. I didn't want the landlady to see. And I knew there were still drops in there. And, I remember the morning where I had this, little sad shot glass and I had to, dig it out from somewhere I long stopped using containers to drink out of. I mean, why bother? I remember going around that room, and I probably took, 20 or 30 empty bottles. And, my hands were shaking. And I thought I didn't even put that together, it was from the alcohol. But I remember my hands shaking, to pour this, the last drop, and I could see it in there, and I'm just shaking it out into that shot glass. And I did that for every single bottle in that room, 20 different bottles, maybe 30. I don't even know. But it was and I remember licking the inside of the bottle. That's powerlessness. That is powerlessness. That's not something I ever want to go back to. I know what that looks like, and that's why I come to these rooms. So that's what happened. I got fired. I got fired from a lot of jobs, and I came back home to live with my mom. I had one last chance to get it right. I was going to be a manager of a Friendly's, and it was even a better job than all my previous failures. And I remember I went down for the training. The training was about 40 minutes from my house, and for the first week, I did so well. I didn't drink at work. And then that second week, it's it reminds me of Bill's story, or not Bill's story, but it reminds me, and I think it's more about alcoholism. Suddenly the thought crossed my mind that maybe if I put a little whiskey in the glass of milk, it was one of those moments, where we just think, well, maybe if I did this. And, suddenly the thought crossed my mind, and before I knew it, I did not have that job anymore. I can't even really tell you what happened, but I was living back with my mom at that point. Now she's asking questions. My stepfather at the time was dying of lung cancer, and so it was just, but so she was kind of otherwise occupied, but I knew eventually I was going to be found out. I kept telling her, they just don't need me this week. And she's like, aren't you supposed to be the manager? just don't need me this week. I remember my last drink, I woke up, I finished that last quarter, or not even finished that. I drank a couple swigs from the bottle. I went and took my baby sister to school because I did stuff like that a lot. And I remember coming home, and I remember, I don't remember a whole lot, but I remember thinking, now what? Now what? You have no job. You have no money. You're scraping together quarters just to get your bottle. Now what? And I don't know what happened. I have no idea what happened. I must have said a prayer. Everyone says they said a prayer and they meant it. So I think that's what happened. I had a couple drinks in me. But I remember watching a music video. It was a Daughtry video for Over You. And I watched this video probably while drinking. And I remember the girl in the video had a problem. And she was at an AA meeting at the time. It was like I had never heard of AA. The only thing I knew of AA is that Lindsay Lohan went to it and kept her chips on her bracelet because I read all those garbage magazines. And that was the only thing I had ever heard about. Seriously, that was the only thing I'd ever heard about AA. But I watched this Daughtry video that morning. And this girl stands up at the end and she says, hi, my name is Sarah. And then they cut it off. But for some reason, I knew she was at an AA meeting. I just knew. And I looked in the newspaper. I thought our meetings were listed in the newspaper. I just thought that, community events, I thought that made sense. But didn't get me very far. So I called a hotline, and I always say I call the hotline because it's a really important service commitment. It's one that I hate, okay? I hate having the hotline because I always get the wackos. I think everybody does, but of course it's all about me, so I always get the wackos. But I make myself take that hotline commitment when it's my home group's turn because, you know, somebody was there for me when I called that hotline. Somebody answered that phone. And I'm not taking her inventory, but she told me about a meeting like 3 days from then. And now that I've been sober a little bit, I'm like, she should probably come and got me. But, you know, I'm over it, I promise. But I'm like, thank God. She's like, I remember I like had really bad DTs, and I didn't know what DTs were, but I had them. I found out later. And she was like, you'll be fine. Like, you'll be okay. God bless her. I wish I knew who she was. But I call this hotline, you know, and that's how I found out about AA. And I'm one of those people that talks about the need that serious medical attention. You see, I couldn't have ever predicted that because I'm 21, you know. I'm only 21. I've only been drinking for 4 years at the time. So I couldn't possibly have all these things wrong with me. Well, I went to Hershey Medical Center. I drove myself there. And I remember not even thinking I could drive because, you know, and I remember the triage nurse at the ER said, hasn't this happened to you before? Like, and I realized, and I'm like, no, but I realized it's because I hadn't not been drunk for like a year. So maybe it had, maybe it would have, but I remember my arm was twitching. I could not stop it. It was horrible. I remember thinking, if I only would have known this, I never would have picked up a drink. It was horrible. I've gone through lots of withdrawals, okay, of outside issues, and you name. I've gone through lots of it. And for me, other people will argue with me, but it's not important. For me, nothing is the same as that last trip. Nothing is horrible. I never want to go back there. And so I went to the ER, and I remember going up and saying, I have no insurance, but I think I'm withdrawing from alcohol, because of course I still want to sound collegiate, you know, I'm withdrawing from alcohol. And I remember her saying, that's okay, and, you know, they hooked me up, and I remember them Hershey Medical Center is a teaching hospital, right? So they bring all these med students and interns and residents in to see this 21-year-old girl with late-stage alcoholism. And I remember thinking, how did I get here? How did I get here? I can't even. But the irony is, I now am an employee at Hershey Medical Center. I work in there. I work in breast cancer research, and hopefully, I'll get to some of how all that happened, but it's ironic because, like, now you're allowed to access your own chart. Nobody else is, of course, but you're allowed to access your own chart. And just recently, like, right around the time I picked up my 5-year chip, just for fun, you know, I went back to that night. Let's just see how much of a mess you really were. And I had read the notes from before, and they're so embarrassing. I have some medical training now, and so I now know, like, what, like, numbers mean, like, lab values, and, like, it was scary, you know, it's scary when I look at it, because I know now I have patients that if their lab values were like that, I'd be freaked out, and I can't believe I was in that kind of condition. I had no idea I was killing myself. I remember the doctor telling me at the time, you know, that my systems were shutting down, that if you would not have come here, you may not be alive, that my potassium was so low, I would have lost the use of my legs forever because my organs were shutting down. And I'm 21, y'all, you know, 21 years old. That's scary to me when I think about today. But thank goodness I got there. They shipped me off to a detox. I did a stint there. I would like to tell you that's my sobriety date, but it's not. That is the last time I picked up a drink. The last time I picked up a drink was November 20th of 2007, but you'll notice December 27th. Because I really, and I feel so necessary that I mention this in an AA meeting because I am not the dumbest girl in the world. I'm not the smartest, but I'm not stupid. And yet, I had no idea when I got here that the marijuana maintenance program that you talked about was not a real thing. I swear on everything. I swear. Somebody said that, and I was like, sweet. Like, this is going to work after all. So I picked up a 30-day chip. Probably couldn't see it very well, but I did pick it up. And anyway, I ended up going to rehab because apparently I had a morphine maintenance program too, but that doesn't work so well. But I ended up going to rehab, and it was the best thing that ever happened to me, because I can honestly tell you that for the first time in my life, I was among my fellows. I was among people who loved me, and I didn't know why they loved me, because I sure didn't love me. I didn't know why they were accepting me, because I felt so out of place and unaccepted. But I went to this treatment center, and, you know, I threw that 30-day chip away. Somebody called me on it. Because I went to that treatment center with every intention of continuing my maintenance program on the way out. I just was taking care of the other stuff. But I'm proud to say that I haven't continued that program. Because for me, I can't have anything get in between me and God today. That's just it. I'm not gonna debate medications. That's not my place. That's not Alcoholics Anonymous' place. Actually, that's an outside issue. And I believe that there are people who have a legitimate need for certain medications. However, for me, for this alcoholic, that's just my hot ticket back to a relapse, you know. So I came into these rooms, and like, you were all so weird because you're so nice, and I'm not used to nice people. I hung out with a lot of people who wanted from me, what can you do for me, what can I, you know, that's, and I don't blame them, I'm not taking their inventory, I was the same way, you know, I hung out, I judged you on how good your stuff was, how good your drink was, if there was going to be enough for me in it, and, excuse me, and, that was as close as I ever had to a real friend. And I got here, and I remember my first meeting, and this was probably when I was still in my maintenance program, but it still sticks out to me. So this woman, Maureen, she, after the meeting, she, like, gave me a big book, and I was like, why is she giving me this Bible? Like, I swear, I was like, I thought it was a Bible or something. I'm like, oh, my gosh, what did I get myself into? I went and researched AA, and I'm like, just, please don't be like me when I got here, because I really wanted to figure it out, because I was somebody that always needed to have an explanation for everything. But thank goodness you all put up with me. You know, I was that girl that every single meeting I had something to say. Before I had any experience to share with you, before I had any strength or hope, I was going to give you my opinion on the fifth step that I hadn't worked yet, you know, because that was just, that was me. I loved the sound of my own voice. I loved talking the game. I loved talking the talk. I couldn't walk the walk to save my life, but I thought you knew. You knew. I did. But you told me to keep coming back, you know, and, you know, I'm very grateful for that, because you could have, you know, I had people tell me, you know, take the cotton out of your ears and put it in your mouth, or I had people tell me stuff like that. I had people be really unkind to me, but thank goodness some of you were there to stroke my ego or something, because I think we have to be really careful how we treat people when they get here, because it's easy for me today, standing here at 5 years sober, and having worked steps through time and time again, and having sponsored women and working with a sponsor and doing service work and all that jazz. It's really easy for me to be like, she's not doing anything I tell her to, you know. But, and I don't believe at all in watering down this program, but I do believe in letting people be human beings, you know, because I'm certainly not perfect, and I certainly have a lot of work to do. And I think sometimes, you know, I'm very careful about how I treat people who come in, especially from treatment centers and institutions and rehabs, because, you know, especially with the outside issue stuff, you know, because to be honest, they don't know any better. I didn't know any better. When I was in treatment, they said, go to any meeting, any fellowship, doesn't matter, just go to one, you know? So I really came in here thinking that. I think it is important to keep our primary purpose primary, but I think we also have to do it in a loving and kind way, because above all things, you know, however somebody identifies when they say their name, above all things, it tells me in this book that love and tolerance of others is our code, you know? And I wish I could say, I see a lot of love and tolerance in AA, and I do. I shouldn't have said that. I wish I could say that, you know, that it was our code, because code really means, like, our way of life, you know, how we do things. That's our deal. And unfortunately, you know, I know for me, I can forget that. I can forget about that love and tolerance thing, and I think it's so important that, you know, when people come here and they say the wrong thing, or they do the wrong thing, you know, the wrong thing, that we just treat them with love and kindness, because that's what I got when I got here. You know, people were so kind to me. People pointed out somebody and said, that's going to be your temporary sponsor, you know, and thank God that you guys took care of me. You know, thank God that you showed me that there was a way to live. You showed me. You didn't tell me what to do. You didn't bark at me. Some of you did, but I needed it. But thank goodness you showed me a better way of life. You know, and I went through a couple sponsors, because, you know, the one was very ill, so she didn't have time for me, and she passed me off to a woman who drank, and so she passed me off to a, you know, I kind of got passed, and I had another woman who didn't want to work the steps with me, and I was like, okay, well, that's kind of why I'm here, so, but I did finally get with a woman who was willing to take me through this book, and through these steps. And it changed my life. And, you know, when it sounds so cliche, it changed my life. It changed my life. It changed the person who I was. It changed the way I did things, the way I thought, the way I acted, the way I treated others. I remember being a couple months sober and sharing at a meeting, like flapping off at the gums like I do, you know, just wow, you know, double, triple dipping like I did. And I remember being like, well, that I'm just a B-I-T-C-H. That's just who I am. And I remember this old-timer, EJ, he's no longer with us, but this old-timer was like, yeah, but that's not okay today. And I was like, oh. Because that was the first time anybody had ever said, because I really thought it was okay, because that's just who I am. That's just me. If you don't like it, see ya. Sorry. I was so arrogant when, you know, I used to think like the world revolved around me, but it was all front. It was all front because I was so insecure, but I didn't know that. And I'd be out like whatever I used to do, and a guy would ask for my number, and I would start giving it to him, and he'd take out his phone and I'd be like, no, if you want it that bad, you'll remember it. Like who did I think I was? Like who does that? That's so rude. They remembered it, but anyway. But, no, seriously, thank goodness you guys told me that it's not okay to be an a-hole anymore, because I don't want to be that person today, because I stayed in these rooms for a long time and still gossiped at the water fountain, and, you know, that girl, we need to pray for her, she's just, you know, and it was like, I was coming from a good place. No, I wasn't. I was gossiping. I was being unkind. I was assassinating character. All right. I was being the same person I was, talking the same talk that I talked on the bar stool. I was doing the same stuff in Alcoholics Anonymous. And thank goodness somebody said, no, that's not okay today. We don't do it that way. Love and tolerance of others is our code. You're going to act right, little girl. Seriously, somebody said that to me. You're going to act right, little girl. Who does he think he is? Well, he was somebody that saved my life. So, you know, so I got here and I went through these steps, and the first step was in the bag. I knew all that, but it really made a difference when I did it from the book, you know, because I thought I knew it all. You know, I remember like in my fourth meeting, like outside of rehab, I'm like quoting from the 12 and 12, and it's like I have not done any work, and I think I can quote from the 12 and 12. But you know, I got to work, and I believe in working these steps as soon as possible. And I'm sure some people don't agree with that. I'm sure, you know, if you have a problem with me saying that, call your sponsor. That's just how I do it. That's just how I do it, because I've seen women in meetings saying, I really, you know, I just want to work my four steps so bad, and my sponsor won't let me. She says I'm not ready for a couple another month. And I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, this is life or death. Stop treating it like it's a garden club. This is my life, okay? This is her life. And if I have a woman ready to work steps, we're going to work steps. And we're going to work them from these books, because that's how we do it. And, you know, and are there time frames in this book? No. But it says in the doctor's opinion, practical application at once. And at once is pretty self-explanatory, if you ask me. So I believe in working these steps as soon as possible. You know, I'm not saying like do them all in one night, but hey, that's how they used to do it back in the day. I'm just saying. If you could, well, I went through these steps, and you know, I got to this fourth step, and this fourth step. Well, no, I go back. Because two and three are so important, because I was absolutely insane. I was absolutely insane, and I had no idea. When I got here, I didn't have a problem with you talking about God. It weirded me out at first. I'm like, oh, it's a cult. It's not, if you're new, but it's not. It's really not. But, you know, I heard you talking about God, and I had always believed in God. I was raised in the Catholic Church, and, you know, I'm actually one of those few people that's okay with that. I have no resentments against that. They never did anything wrong to me, and I respect the Catholic Church. I still do. You know, and I think we have to be careful when we're sharing in meetings that we don't bash certain religions, because some people might come in here, a devout Catholic or Mormon or whatever we are, and we don't need, that's outside issues. We don't need to be talking about that. But anyway, so I came in here and I'd always believed in God, but I had no idea what the heck he had to do with my drinking. You know, that I'm just not here for that. You know, you can go on with all that, but I'm just not here for that. And today I know that not only does he have everything to do with my drinking, he has everything to do with my everything. And he has everything to do with whether or not I can go through this life just a dry, sober individual, or if I can go through this life actually recovered and full of life and enjoying it. Because if all I'm going to do is not drink, give me a gun. If all I'm going to do is just not drink, then it's not worth it. Because I've been there. I've been at that dark night of the soul, as my friend Val calls it, that dark night of the soul where, you know, you can't drink, but you don't want to live anymore. I didn't want to live anymore. I sat in these rooms, and I was miserable. I couldn't get out of bed, and this is 4 years sober. This is just a year ago. And it wasn't always like that, but when I get to that place, I need to remember where I started and where I need to go back to. So I found out that God has anything and everything to do with my drinking, and if you're uncomfortable with the word God, that's fine. I was too. But luckily, it says in Bill's story, we get to choose our own conception of God. And whatever, you know, we get to have this conception of a higher power, and all the only requirement is that it's not me, that it's something greater than me. And it's really not that difficult when you think about it. So I turned my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood him. And I didn't even know what that meant at the time, but I was willing to, you know. I made a decision, and that's all it takes. We make a decision. That little bit of willingness is all it takes. And I made that decision, and I can tell you from the day I made that decision, things changed in the way I thought. Things started changing from the day I took my last drink, but things really started to change when I made that decision. But then I got to work, because it says in our book, faith without works is dead. It says in the Bible too, which I didn't know, but faith without works is dead. And I started writing, and you know, the fourth step was the most liberating process of my life. And you know, I sponsor a girl who's 15 years old. She's amazing. And you know, before I started sponsoring her, she had a sponsor who wouldn't take her through five because you're just not ready. You're just not ready. You know, and this poor girl sitting on her four-step for like 6 months or I forget how long, but a long time. That's a long time to sit on that crap. You know, once I get it out, I need to talk to somebody immediately. And so I did, and I got that stuff down on paper, and I talked about it. And even the worst things, you said you did them too. You know, you said that. Even the thing, that part where your sponsor says, okay, now what didn't you write down? And then I told her, and she said, yeah, that happened to me too. And you know, that's powerful. One alcoholic relating to another. That part in the book where, you know, I'm a big book thumper, okay? And I'm okay with that, all right? And for some reason, it's used very negatively in some places. But I'm like, this book saved my life. Like, I will thump the heck out of this thing because it saved my life. I think where it gets is, like, you can't just talk the talk and not do it, you know? And I get where maybe that came from. But so I am a big book thumper. And I can't tell you exact page numbers, but I remember the first thing I could ever quote from the big book, and not because I studied it, because it really moved my heart. Was the first page of There Is a Solution, where it says, we are people who normally would not mix, but there among us exists a fellowship, a friendship, and an understanding that is indescribably wonderful, you know, and here are these people from all walks of life that are telling me their experience, and they did it just like me. You know, so I got through four and five with this woman who could not have been more opposite than me on paper, but yet she had done the same things I'd done, and when we got to six and seven, and I had no idea how screwed up I was until I got to six and seven. And just, you know, it's so not about the drink for me today, because I haven't had a drink for a long time, and I can still be judgmental and self-centered and self-seeking and controlling if I don't practice these principles in all my affairs. And I don't do this work, if I don't say yes to speaker meetings, and if I don't say yes to new women and say yes to service commitments, I can still go back to all that stuff. So, you know, that whole idea of getting down to the exact nature of our wrongs, you know, the causes and conditions, I'm a big believer, and that's the reason why we maybe make it and others that try other methods don't. And then making amends, you know, I'm running out of time, and making amends is the best. It's the best. Like, it was the scariest part for me. It was the part I feared for the longest time. But making amends, I remember the one bar I worked at that I got drunk on my shift. I walked out, leaving left the bar, like with people in it, like just walked out in the middle of my shift. And I remember they called my boyfriend at the time, one of my hostages, as I like to call him. And, they told me never to come back into that bar again, never to set foot in that bar again. And so when I had to walk back in and make my monetary amends, I was scared. There was two big biker girls, Chris and Lori, and they were going to kill me. And I walked back in, and she said, "Hey, what can I get you?" She didn't even know who I was. And I told her why I was there and what my purpose was, and explained why I was wrong, and told her I was sorry, and gave them the check, and she shook my hand. Like, these people that I had, like screwed over, the stuff that kept me awake at night, like, she's shaking my hand. So making amends, like, the scariest ones were the best. They set me free, and I had, and setting me free, I use that term because I was in bondage, total bondage, from all that stuff. And then 10, 11, and 12 is just, it's the ride, you know, it's the fun part. You know, it's stuff that I have to do on a daily basis because this is the best thing that ever happened to me. This is the best. You know, my friend Greg L. from the Hershey Group, he says, "This is the best show on earth, folks. This is the best, the greatest show on earth." And it's so true. It's the greatest show on earth. And I don't say that to be corny or because I think you might want to hear it, but it's seriously the greatest thing that ever happened to me. It gave me a relationship with God. It gave me a relationship with other people. It gave me this amazing job where I'm doing breast cancer research. I could not hold down a job in a gas station. Not saying anything about that. But I could not hold down a job like selling gas, okay? And now I do cancer research. Are you kidding me? Like, who does? How does that happen in 5 years? It happens because I came in here and, you know, took your suggestions and just tried so hard to do that set aside prayer, you know, that you guys read at the beginning, because I thought I knew everything. And when I got here, I found out that I knew nothing. And for the first time, that was okay. Because remember, I told you I was the kid, the smart kid. And so I thought I had to know everything and I had to have all the answers. And I boast in my weakness today. You know, I'm proud of that. I'm proud that I don't know everything. That gets me off the hook of a lot of things. So, I'm so grateful I'm here. I didn't mention my home group. My home group is the Big Book Study Group in New Cumberland, Pennsylvania. We meet on Tuesday nights at 7 p.m. We read the book. Usually our meetings, we read about a paragraph or two out of the book and share the whole meeting on it. And then if we run out of things to talk about, which usually doesn't happen, we pick up again. It's an awesome meeting. And we are having a primary purpose weekend. The first weekend of May, and you can see me after that, after the meeting, if you want to learn more about that. But it's really cool. We do kind of the same thing, just go through the book. And I always end with this part because when I first got sober, there was a noon meeting right by my house. And let's be honest, I didn't have a license. Who does when we get here? But if you do, like, you're way ahead of the game. But they read this at the end of every meeting, and I honestly thought it was a prayer. For Len, I used to say amen after it because I really thought it was a prayer. But I love the way it sums up our program in a nutshell, so I always like to close with this when I remember to. And it's on the last page. It's the very last page of the meat and potatoes of this book, the first 164. It says, "Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit. And you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny." Not to happy destiny. It's a road of happy destiny. We're already there. May God bless you and keep you until then. I'm Brittany. I'm an alcoholic. Thanks for letting me share.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging a dollar or two a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.